You've entered Bookstorm with Kristen Civiletto and me, Chris Storm. This is a podcast devoted to best-selling books that matter, books that make a difference. We're diving down deep with beloved authors about their stories. We're exposing hot-button topics and heartfelt themes, the issues that affect each of us in our own lives, as siblings, parents, partners, friends, as human beings. We're braving new ideas, fresh thoughts, hard lessons, and important truths. Those kinds of things that stay with us long after we turn the last page and close the book. Welcome back, listeners. We have with us someone that you have been asking for. We've been waiting for this new book to come out. We're super excited to have Sarah McCoy with us today. She's a New York Times, USA Today, and international best-selling author of many novels. You may recognize Marilla of Green Gables, The Mapmaker's Children, The Baker's Daughter, but we're here today to talk to her about her new release, Mustique Island. Sarah is the 2012 Goodreads Choice Award nominee for Best Historical Fiction. Wow. Her work has been featured in Newsweek, Real Simple, The Millions, Literary Hub, Writer's Digest, Huffington Post, and I could go on and on. Sarah was the host of NPR Radio monthly program Bookmarked with Sarah McCoy for many years. She's a board member for the literary nonprofit Bookmarks. Sarah taught English writing at Old Dominion University and Texas. Little on the personal side for our listeners, she's the daughter of an Army officer. Her family was stationed in Germany during her childhood. There's a story behind there, I'm sure. After a decade in El Paso, she now lives with her husband, Dr. Waterman, who's an orthopedic sports surgeon at Wake Forest. And I have to mention, in her bio, she also lives with two fur children, Gilly Pup and Tutu Cat.
Yes, so, one of which is sleeping at my feet right now. So
how adorable. Sarah, thank you for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is a true pleasure. I am so excited to talk to you guys about the book and writing and life and anything really that you ask me, I will answer. I'm an open book to you, so.
We'd love to hear that. We can't wait. We've got some great issues we're going to dive into.
Yeah, we cover it all. Sarah, we'd like to give the listeners just a little bit of the backstory on the book in terms of some of the facts. So if you'll indulge me, I would just like to just not give away any spoilers, of course, but just talk a little bit about what the book is about. First of all, Mustique Island, I think, is a very layered story about a wealthy divorcee and her two headstrong daughters in 1970s Mustique. At the time, Mustique was one of the world's most exclusive private islands, and Princess Margaret and Mick Jagger were regulars, along with a host of other celebrities. We follow in the story Willie Mae. She is a former dirt poor beauty queen. She marries a wealthy Brit, and after her divorce and some other life events, she sets out for Mustique sailing. She decides to put down roots there and rebuild her life and her relationship with her daughters. British entrepreneur and playboy Colin Tennant convinces her to build a beautiful home right opposite Princess Margaret. And she soon finds herself pulled into the island's circle of aristocrats and rock stars and other hangers-on. In the story, her daughters arrive and stay with her, and soon they discover that beneath the surface of decadence, there is much more that is going on, a dark side, but also an existing culture independent of the British living there. This mother-daughter story at heart, to me, will stay with you long after you close the book here. Did you want to add anything in terms of some facts?
Oh my gosh, that was so good. I wish I could take you on book tour and just like have you both intro me to every event I do. No, that was fantastic. That was perfect.
Good. Okay, wonderful. That's- Well, if we're ready to brave the storm, Sarah, Chris, why don't you start us off?
We are ready. So I want our readers to know you are going to love this book. It is an inspiration. It is a life changer. It's a very deep, honest story interwoven with heartbreak, failure, strength, and hope. And the reader's just going to treasure it. One of my favorite characters is Willie Mae, who is the heroine. And she says at one point, and I want to quote, "Everyone wanted to be seen as beautiful, but not everyone was. Everyone wanted to possess certain talents, but not everyone did. Everyone wanted to be the princess or the prince, but not everyone could." The end. I felt a major theme in this novel was that we often do not achieve our dreams. Sometimes relationships fail, we get off course. Some of this is our fault and some is not. And I wondered, were you as the author, were you trying to show the reader something about the importance of fate versus choices?
You know, I definitely, fate and choices are a part of that. But I also, I think my main focus when I was writing that theme, particularly in this book, is that oftentimes we adhere to a predisposed pattern of what happily ever after is, what our dream is. And did we come up with that? Or were we told that? Or were we story told that through generations of passing down what this dream is? And so does that make it the right dream for us though? So I think that goes to what you said about fate and choices. And I think we need to be careful, because if you look at these dreams, most of them are unattainable. That's why they are fantasies. That's why they are fairy tales. You know, like you just read, we're not all princesses and princes. In spirit, we can feel that way, absolutely. But here on earth, we are not all given that sort of crown. And I want to make a note that there is a, you can feel, I encourage people to feel themselves of a certain higher calling and higher authority. So feel yourself a princess, feel yourself a prince. I don't want to ever take that away from people, but that sort of pattern of prince meets princess, you live in a castle, you have the big wedding, and at the end of the show, everyone goes off in a carriage and lives happily ever after. That's fantasy. Like, if you're living for that dream, you will be disappointed because you're human. And that doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't mean that your story is a bad story because you didn't follow the narrative arc for a happily ever after. And because we are human and humanly flawed, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to mess up. We're going to do things that are wrong, even though we know that they're wrong, even though we other people tell us that they're wrong. We just, that is part of being human. Doesn't make them right or wrong either, those mistakes you make, but they are part of our becoming process. And that is another something that I really delved into in this book, is there is no beginning and end. That's part of that fairy tale. That's part of that mystique, because it's mystique, but that is the mystique of living that dream that we sometimes put on ourselves, is that we have a beginning and a middle and an end, and it should go a certain way, when really we are in an ever-evolving transformational process of becoming something better than we were before. You know, a better mother, a better friend, a better spouse. That's all part of our story, and that's all part of your dream. And so I think we need to be open to saying, you know, I had a dream of what my life would be when I was this age, but that is not something I have to stick to. Like, I can change my mind and I can have a different dream when I'm middle-aged, and I can have a different dream when I'm older, and that's okay. I think we live in a society that says And it's good to keep your word. I am a woman who believes in what you say, you should keep that word. But we sometimes lock people into what they said they would do or said they would be, or even ourselves. We say, I said by, 30, I would have 3 kids. Well, 30 hits, and why should that, something you've placed on yourself, suddenly make your life and your dream not fulfilled? Because you place that sort of narrative structure on your own dream life like that. So that was all part of it. And there's no real answer to what you just said, I think, or your question. I think fate and choices, they're all working in tandem towards that becoming process for each of us. So I believe in fate, but I also believe that our choices influence that fate. And ultimately, good or bad choices we make, our fate then becomes our purpose. And it can be a good purpose that we go towards. But again, that's a choice. Our fate can be a good purpose, or our fate can be a not so good purpose, but we decide. So did I answer? Did I just ramble?
No, you gave so many great points that I could talk about them forever. But also in the definition of fate, meaning just things that happen in the world around us that we have no control of. And this sometimes occurs. But there was one other thing I wanted to touch on that you just spoke about. People in this story, Willie Mae in particular, did break out of a mold and began to achieve what she thought was her dream. So then we have this notion of, we set a goal, we think we have a dream, maybe we put too much emphasis upon that one dream, we reach it, and we're not fulfilled. Yeah. And also the celebrities that came to the island, as we see with famous celebrities today, you would think in your mind that people would be so happy having achieved this wealth and fame, and yet they may even be worse off psychologically than we are. I think you showed the reader a little of this as well in that quote by Willie Mae, that she was realizing, I didn't meet my dreams, but is there anything, one thing that you could achieve on this earth that would really give you complete and total satisfaction? I don't know.
And that's something I absolutely dug into, is that idea of fame. Because right now in our society, I've met so many people of the younger generation where they, and I remember feeling this, that's why I empathize. They want to be famous, right? That's their goal. They don't know how to get there, but they know that that feels good. They're getting all those likes on Instagram. So that fame feels good on a small scale, on a micro scale. So they want it on a macro scale. They don't know how to get there. And so that becomes their goal. Like, that becomes their whole goal. And I empathize, because I remember being young and wanting to not be necessarily be famous, but wanting to be known, yes. Right? I wanted to be known. I wanted to make an impact in the world. I wanted there to be something that I provided or created that I was leaving or giving out into the world, that when I'm gone, people would say Sarah McCoy was alive and she was here. And I think that's what the younger generations are actually feeling, that same feeling, is that they want to be known, not necessarily famous, but they don't understand that concept. And so in this, I was really wanting to show all these famous, Princess Margaret, Mick Jagger, even Colin and Ann Tennant, for their time in the 70s, they were famous. I mean, if you got invited to one of their parties, wow, you must be really important stuff in the world, because they only had the cream of the cream at their place. So, like, they were famous in their own way. But where are they now? And what have they left to us, good and bad? What have they left to the world? And how do we reflect on them now? And so I wanted all that to go into this book. And again, I don't write my books, maybe this is too confessional, but I don't write my books to give any answers. I actually write my own questions in my books. I'm asking my characters, because I'm asking myself, because I'm asking the world, because I'm trying to figure it all out, because I know I'm in my mid-40s. Times like I'm back at the beginning in my, you know, as a tween, even like very young, like 12 years old, like, whoa, when you first have that moment when you realize I am not of my parents, like I am my own individual and I have my own life and my own action in this world. And there's this sort of light bulb that goes off where you feel both empowered and terrified, because now what? And so sometimes at this age, even I have those light bulbs where I'm like empowered and then I'm terrified, because I'm thinking I don't have the answers and I don't understand what's going on around me still, and I don't understand what this means to be struggling with some of these things that we're struggling with now. And so I put it all into my books, and that's fame and what you leave behind and achieving that goal. So then what? So then what?
Yeah.
And that shocks a lot of people, because they think that when they achieve the goal, the happily ever after, when they get there, then they're going to be happily ever after.
Yeah.
When really you wake up the next morning and now what? Now what do I do with my world and my life? And if you burned, you know, the burning of Atlanta, that's what I think of. If you burned it all the way to get there, and then you get to this end goal and you meet it, but at the end, your health is gone, you're exhausted, you're sick, or whatever has happened to you, you have no relationships left.
Yep.
You have done everything that, you know, that was necessary, you thought at the time, to get to this goal.
Mm-hmm.
Was it worth it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the question that I asked in this book. Is it worth it?
Mm.
And sometimes you think it is, and sometimes you think it isn't. And even in that, you're making choices then about where you go forward and what you do next.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that's in the book. And
I
don't have it figured out yet either. So,
yeah. You know, that really resonates too, because my generation, at least, we were raised on these fairy tales. And that narrative was put forth in our formative years, this idea of the princess marrying the prince and happily ever after. And I think we're doing better now in terms of equipping young people, but sometimes I'm not so sure. But very wise words.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, I want to go in a little bit of a different direction too, because we're going deep. We're going to go equally
sure,
deep.
Sure, yes. Okay.
I think there are so many layers to explore in this novel, because you really do deal with motherhood and sisterhood, class distinctions, colonialism, the fate and faith and choices that we were talking about a second ago. It's very rich. But I was really struck by Colin Tennant and his character, because he was a man who really strove to present his own, you know, theatrically inspired version of this magical mystique to the world. And there was one scene that really I thought was brilliant, and that is when he was entertaining a gourmet magazine writer and put on this elaborate show. Now, he didn't present the foods that were grown on Mustique, he imported them, but presented this false view of something. And I was wondering if, you know, it wasn't just about the financial aspect for him. He was sure he was a developer, he wanted to make money. But I was wondering if he was trying to create Mustique as a place to escape those strictures of British society, where he was expected to act as a certain member of a certain class. But Mustique was a place where he felt he could be his authentic self, even if he was remaking the island in a non-authentic way. I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
Absolutely. And that scene, actually, I'm like sitting here looking at it. So Colin was a real person. And I'm going to get into that thing, but that scene came straight out of an actual gourmet magazine, the actual feature. That was actually real. All of that was real. I mean, down to the bananas.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. All of that. I didn't make that up. So, and Colin, you know, like I said, I don't have answers. I ask questions, and Colin is a real person. I have his memoir. and I read it, and I still have not figured this man out. I mean, I don't understand what made him tick. And the only thing I can think is that I do think that he was someone who didn't know who he was and wanted to be his authentic self, but didn't wasn't sure who that was or what that was. And so he just put it all out there. He found this island, and he knew that in England, and he could not do all the wild shenanigans that he was doing at the time. And so I think that on this island, he was able to test the waters. I'm being careful of how I put this. He was able to test the waters in certain ways, with his sexuality, with the way he dressed, with the way he entertained people. I think he was a lost soul. I actually hurt for him because he was eccentric and he was dark in ways, and yet he was very like clown-like in ways, like party, 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 happy, 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 and manic. I get a sense he was probably suffering from some sort of mania. And so Anne Glenconner is real, his wife, and she last year put out a memoir called Lady in Waiting by Anne Glenconner. And in it, she talks about her marriage and about Mystique and about, her life in England. And she depicts him exactly as I depicted him and exactly as he is in this memoir, as just out of control. Really, just out of control, the things, and scandalous and shocking, even more shocking in her memoir, and the things that he made her do. I'll just leave like what he made her do. So I don't know. To answer your question, I don't know what made him tick, but I like taking people that I don't understand, and instead of judging them, I would like to understand them. And that's just how I do it. But I don't agree with a lot of what he did, and I don't agree with a lot of what he stood for, but I actually became very empathetic through the writing of his character because I realized he's a person just like all of us. He has a dark side and a light side, and he was trying to figure it out. And I really felt he probably needed someone to say, no matter what you do, you are loved. That's what I get from him, is he needed someone in his life to say, no matter what you do, you will still be loved. And I don't think he heard that even from his wife. I don't think he got that. Speaking of finding your dream and your happy ending, I don't think he got that from clearly his parents. He described them as not being very loving. They're very kind of cold British sort. I don't think he got that from his children. I don't, not from his wife. So he was searching. I think he was on this island searching for understanding, for acceptance, and for love. And that to me is a very, that's a, even though he put on the all these shows and he was kind of a clown, that's someone to have a heart for and to be compassionate towards. So in the book, he is wild and he is bright and he is over the top and colorful and all those things, but I refuse to judge him. And I think with all my characters, I refuse to judge any character. I don't care what their actions are. I don't care if it's like the worst thing ever you could ever imagine a person doing. Okay, so let's deal with that. They're still human. They still have a heart and feelings and a soul. So let's deal with that. So I don't think I answered your question. I'm sorry.
No, no,
But
no,
I
you
don't have him
absolutely
figured
did.
out.
You absolutely did. And, he was a very complicated character, but all of your characters were, because they were really all struggling with this idea of assessing themselves and understanding really who they are, and then having relationships reflect that. And again, it goes even back to Willie Mae, just reassessing who she is as a mother and developing or redeveloping relationships that have suffered because of what she thought she should be or who she was. Excellent. And I like against the backdrop too of an existing rich culture. You know, right? Because mm-hmm. Colin Tennant kind of imposing this idea yeah. and this vision on an existing, rich, beautiful culture that existed yes. even before he got there.
Yes. And that was something very important and dear to me because I am a Puerto Rican woman. My mother is Puerto Rican. And so my family, that whole side pretty much still lives in Puerto Rico in that Caribbean culture. And I found that really interesting that all these islands are right next to each other in this sort of curve. And, you know, one is French, one is British, one is, you know, they're all just determined by who came and colonized them and who stayed as colonizer, because some of them first were French and then they were Spanish and then they were British and they've been all over. And, but who stays are the actual people who are from the island, who live and stay there and work the land and bring up their young and generations pass down. And that was really important to depict them as a source of power, as in power, even though they are the minority under these colonizing forces. And again, it's exactly what you said. It's the difference between who you know you are and who you portray to be. So Mystique Island, just like Puerto Rico, just like St. John's, just like the Bahamas, the people, they know who they are. No matter what the show is, no matter what cruise ships come and dock and they put on their like little dancey and like do the, you know, the drum beat and all that, they know who they are. And they know, you know, how to then play nice with whatever colonizers or whoever is coming onto the island, because they're smart people. And they know that if this is how we're going to, you know, if this is how we're going to do it and we're going to survive and thrive like this, then let's do this for this time, because eventually they're going to get sunburned. They're going to go home. And this is still our island. And so I definitely brought those minor characters to the surface of this book. And I wanted to play with the idea, again, narratively, that so you have your major characters. And in a typical, and this is another theme in my book, is sort of battling what is traditional and what is conventional, mm-hmm. and breaking sort of those confines of whatever that is. And that definitely adhered to my own writing. Like, you come into a book and you expect to be given as a reader 2 to 3, maybe 4 real strong protagonists. Those are your people. You're going to follow them through this book. That's the contract that you're used to getting from the author. Well, what happens if you get this contract and the minority characters suddenly become more powerful, and you realize that the protagonist characters are actually really kind of flip-floppy, waffling on who they are and what they do, and they're not sure, and they're figuring it out, and they're evolving through this novel, and the minority characters are actually then the stronger major characters. They're the majors. They're the strongholds of this book, sort of holding the pillars up while these other characters are crafting their way through and figuring it out. So that was really, and I know that's super crafty. That's super like writing-ish. And a lot of readers would be like, I never would have got that out of the book. But I, as a writer, I like to read books where I feel like the author trusts me as a smart reader. And so I write my books for a smart reader. And even if on the first pass, they don't get some of these layers, or that the narrative structure has now made the protagonist sort of the side and the major or the minor characters rise up, eventually when they're thinking about it or they're having their book club discussion and they're talking about it, they'll be like, you know what? That Candace, that housekeeper, she keeps coming to my mind. That, or, you know, that Titus, who was the business manager, he keeps coming to my mind. And that's because they are the pillars and the they'll get it in a subtle way and not just like slammed over their head, you know, at the beginning of like, this is going to be a major character, please follow them. So that's how I sort of brought that culture, that rich culture into this book.
I felt that as a reader. I noticed that because I loved the people that had grown up on the island and lived there. There were a few scenes where the wealthy would come to the island and they would almost look comical or ridiculous in the eyes of the islanders. And you saw it, you thought, they're making fools of themselves in a way, because the visitors were looking for a fantasy, including Colin. Didn't feel he lived in the real world. He wanted to escape the real world. That's why we go, you know, to the Caribbean, and we think everything is a fantasy. The people living there realized, no, this is real life, and we're making a wonderful living here, and thank you for coming and sharing your wealth or whatever, but they're grounded. Yeah. You know, and they know enough to see what's real and what isn't, and they stay. Because it is a beautiful existence, and you're on a tropical island. But I caught that with them, and there's nothing better.
You're a smart reader, that's why.
I always do think so. But I also love, there's nothing better than a minor or, at first glance, a weaker character coming out with inner strengths that we at first did not see, because we can all relate to it as human beings. We want to see that underdog, or the person who hasn't been given the opportunity, sort of shine in their own special way. And you did that.
Good. And I actually, what you just said reminded me that I've also been on both sides. So the tourists who come onto the island, I am so about not judging either side. That I've been that tourist many times where I've gone to other islands, or I've gone even, you know, to cities in Europe or something that's not even an island, where you come in and you're like, oh, you know, Eiffel Tower, you know, like you just like, I'm going to get a trinket from the Eiffel Tower because this is fun. So I know what that is too. And there's a joy in discovering someplace new. And like you just said, it was brilliant. There's a joy in feeling that you have now dropped yourself into the fantasy, mm-hmm. and you get to live this fantasy. Mm-hmm. And that is something to celebrate too. But I think it's in the book, I try to portray both sides and how you need to be cognizant of both sides, because the danger is when you think that one side or the other is reality, you know, because reality is, that's that other theme in this book that I played with. Clearly I had way too much time during the pandemic. That's what we're going to say, because yeah, but is that, what is reality? Like, what is it, your perspective, or is it my perspective, or is it, you know, is it my husband? Is it your husband? Who is telling this reality of history? Because I could sit down at dinner, and I'm sure you all have the same experience with my husband, and talk about what we saw at the grocery store, you know, the people that we walked by, and it would be a completely different fact-telling of what happened. Mm-hmm. Completely different. I mean, similar, and like, we went to the grocery store, and we went in this aisle, and we saw this man, but like, different. Just different in the feeling, different in the, oh, I was so excited they had quail eggs. And he's like, what? Quail eggs? What are quail eggs? You know, I didn't even notice that. I noticed they were out of chips. And like, we each see reality just so different. And so that was something that I definitely played with in this book, is that much, 50% actually, of history is not written down. Because 50% of it is written by the majority white men of our time. And the other 50% are minority women, minorities and women. And so their stories aren't written down, not in most of history. And so that is interesting to me. And that's why also this book wasn't written from the perspective of Colin, or from one of the men. And, you know, I've done in my books chapters where I've done POV from male perspective. And actually, I think just about, well, except for Marilla of Green Gables, but I've always had a male perspective. And I didn't in this one because I felt like there is a, right here next to me, there is a 500 page memoir by Colin that, do you want to see it? I'll show it to you.
Show us a picture. We'll pull it up.
I mean, this thing is just nuts. Look how thick this is. This is crazy. So this is his book. He titled it, obviously. Do we see this cover? It should not be. Nothing about this cover is politically correct in 2022. Mm-mm. So this, he wrote this book. He published it. It's out there. He told his story. And I felt like this is a chance for someone else. This is a chance for these women to tell their story. And they are, in Willie Mae is inspired by a real woman and her daughters, who I found in this book, in like two paragraphs in this book, that just said that one of the residents that he wooed to come over to the island was this ex-beauty queen from Texas. And she was divorced and she had no place to go. She'd been blackballed from English society. So he said, come play, have fun, come with me. You know, it's almost like Candyman from Willy Wonka or something. Come, come, children. So she went there and invited her two daughters over. And when I saw that, I heard her voice, that Texas twang, probably because I lived there for so long. I knew that the grit of those women, because I think I became that living there for so long. And I thought, no, this isn't some soft little butterfly who just, some little firefly, even though she built her house called Firefly. This isn't some soft little firefly that just sort of landed on the island. And this woman has some grit to her and she's got some stuff to work out. And so that became these characters. And I think especially during this time period, the 1970s, when women's movement was coming of age and religion was also becoming, the evangelical movement was really taking root. And those are two very, well, not those two, but there was the sort of the free love during that time, was really big and coming off the hippie movement. And so you had free love and you had evangelicalism, and then you had the women's movement, and then you had, you know, the queen. We just celebrated her jubilee, so it's still on everyone's mind, but like the queen was very proper and that was being celebrated to some extent, but all these dichotomies.
With a hurricane thrown in there for a dose of reality.
Yes. You know,
that was such an interesting character to me in some respects, the hurricane, because it was, I don't care what your perspective is, it affects all. Now, some can respond differently, fly off the island or stay, but fascinating and brilliant. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I love that. I love, we love, Kristen and I both love, we love all fiction, but we love a story that takes a little true piece of history and we don't have all the answers. And the author creates something surprising, some of it we want to hear, and we work and struggle right along with those characters. That was what made this such a really beautiful and multi-layered story. There's so many emotions that this pulls up in you, and I just loved it. I wanted to talk about this word. One of Hilly's Brazilian teachers used this word. I think I'm pronouncing it right, but tell me if I'm not. Saudade? 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 I'm pronouncing it like with a Hispanic accent. I think that sounds...
No, that's perfect, yeah.
Okay. They used it to describe, and this really hit me, and I thought about this for a long time. It described the melancholy of missing things within a logical fervor. For example, a person no longer present, a place no longer reachable, a time in life long past, a feeling that cannot be replicated. And I thought, you as the writer made us think, do we all long for this? Things of the past, little moments in time that we wish we could bring back, and maybe we linger too much upon? At first thought, I thought, this is not healthy. But then as I thought, well, maybe it is. Maybe it's okay to hold on to a little treasure from the past if it helps us through life. What are your thoughts on that?
You nailed it. Again, as through this conversation, I think you've kind of seen that I love pairing things that are supposedly black and white, right or wrong, and then saying, nope, there's actually not one side or the other. There's this right in between business, because we're all sort of this sort of like, is it this way or is it this way? Is it? So I think you're right. I think we all have that longing for things that are gone. And yet we know that if we had them back, it wouldn't be the way they were. It's like, exactly. It's like childhood, you know? So for example, my brother and I, we often, he'll get things like toys, like a Nintendo set he got. And he was like, oh, it's like from our childhood, you know, it's Nintendo, Sarah. And I'm like, okay, but now I'm in my 40s and this is, Mario Brothers was fun when we were five or, you know, whatever, however age we were. But now I'm just sort of like, beep, 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 beep. Okay. Is this over yet? Are we done having this bonding moment again? It's kind of like that for, you know, where you can't ever go back. And we have, you know, you have such fond memories of people and places and events and things. And I think that we need to, I think remembering and cherishing them for what they were is important. And I think traditions are important, but I think you have to be able to say that was then and renew your mind about who you are now, what you are now, renew. If you get locked into what was, I think that's when it becomes detrimental to your own personal growth. And so even things that are wonderful, like playing Nintendo, that if I sit on the couch with my brother, like we used to do when we were kids, and play Nintendo for 10 hours straight, right now as an adult, that's no bueno, you know, that's not healthy. So I think, but some people feel like, oh, you know, if it was good at one point in my life, it should be good now. And that, again, we talked about this at the beginning of the hours, that you need to be able to say what I thought was my dream then, what I thought was my pleasure then, what I thought was the ultimate then. I'm not yoked to that. Like, I can break out of that and it can be something different now, but I can still appreciate what it was back then, but I can leave it there and move on and move forward. And I think it's important for us to cherish our memories and our traditions in the past, but not make them our future, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
So we need to live in the present and move into a future and be open armed to whatever comes in that future as our new dream, as part of, you know, our new goal setting, and not be, because that can be a detriment. That can just rein us back. So
absolutely. Wise words there, Sarah.
Yeah. And Sarah, if you just have one more minute, I had one more question. Please. I know we've taken a lot of your time. Kind of picking up on that theme of moving into the future, we see a situation where your heroine, Willie Mae, escaped some very controlling circumstances. And then she repeats some of those same actions with regard to her parenting and people around her. And there is a point where she decides that today is a good day to start being the mother that she knows that she could be. And she starts to work on that relationship very intentionally. And I was wondering, you know, how that came into play, because many people find it difficult to, as an older person, try to repair relationships because you have to admit you made some mistakes. And she does that. I was wondering what you thought was the catalyst for that here.
For me, that is sort of something I have in my own personal life, is that it is never too late to redeem yourself. It is never too late for anyone. And we talked about this earlier. I said, the worst thing you can imagine, you know, like murderers on death row, there is a moment when they can say, You know what? I'm facing the consequences of my actions, but I'm gonna be in this moment today, like Willie Mae says, today I'm going to start being what I wish I had been before, or what I wish I had had as a mother. Murder on Death Row can say, today I might be gone tomorrow, but today I am going to start living to be my best self, to be a higher calling, to be what, they can, you can make a change at any point, no matter what you've done or who you are. And I think that message needs to be put out there more to people, because people feel like, I've done so much, I can't, I've messed it all up. Willie Mae feels like, I've messed it all up. I've messed up my daughters. They're a mess. I'm a mess. I thought I wanted to be one way, and then I changed my mind. I thought this man that I married, this British brewery baron, that he would be my ultimate, and then I would be part of good society, and then I would live this fabulous life, and I would have my daughters, and I would be set. And then I messed that up, or that was messed up to begin with, or whatever. And now I have no place to go, and I'm circling the globe. And now I'm on this island with Colin Tennant, who's asking me to dress up and play games. So now I've messed this up. And again, you can feel that way about anything, and yet you can make that decision at any point and say, no, today it starts, and I am different today. So that's where that comes from, is I felt like her character was always ultimately going towards that through the book. I am a woman who I do not, you might feel the same way. I do not like investing 400, 300, 400 pages of my life and my spirit into a book to have it end just tragic and awful, and everyone is just more miserable than they were when they started, and that's the reality of the world. And then I close it and I think, oh my gosh, someone hand me, like, the Hallmark Channel or something, because I'm just so depressed. Like, I don't like reading that. And I said this earlier, I write the fiction that I can't find and I want to read. So I write the stories that I haven't found yet, I haven't heard yet, and I really, really want to read them. So where is that? And part of that is having, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily, I wrote a piece called In Defense of the Happy Ending for a Literary Hub. And I believe, though, that the definition of happy ending, I tweak it. And I think a happy ending is an ending that has hope and satisfaction for my readers. So I always want to give readers hope and satisfaction, so they close the book and they feel like they've learned something, and they've been inspired, and hopefully maybe change their own life by living out whatever has happened with my characters, good and bad. But that's definitely a goal of mine. And speaking of goals, is to have a reader close my book and say, I feel hopeful. I feel like today I can go forward, even just an hour after I read this book, feeling new, feeling a little bit new. So.
And we're here to tell you, as readers, that you have achieved that goal. And thank you for having that purpose and plan as a writer. We just adored this book. We want to tell all of our listeners, this is a life changer. We vet our books here at Bookstorm. We only pick books that matter. And listeners, you're going to love this Mystique Island by Sarah McCoy. And before we leave, Sarah, what's on your radar? Could you just give us a hint of what you might be working on next?
Yes, I'm so close-lipped about writing, just because I want to be able to, if it doesn't work, I want to be able to scrap it all and start on something else without feeling like, oh no, I told everyone. So what I can tell you is that I really like this more modern time period. So 70s through the 90s. I'm sticking with that. I really like, because it's just far enough away that younger generations of readers feel like it's historical, but it's right, but it's just close enough to us where we're like, whoa, I've got t-shirts that are that age, you know,
That's
like
right.
from that time period. Like, what are we talking about? And it has a lot of connection to our memories, even while younger generations are learning then about that time period. So I'm sticking with that. And I'm really excited about it. I can tell you that much. And it's going to be another, female focused book, but
Great.
historical fiction, I guess they'll call it, even though it's closer. Yeah, that's a weird genre because now it's like, well, do we call the 90s? I mean, if someone starts calling the 90s historical, I may just break down.
I'm in
Like, I
trouble.
really might have.
I'm in trouble if they start calling that historical too. Well, we're just
I
as excited as you are about whatever you have coming up here next. We're going to be on the watchful eye for it. We want to tell our readers we just love Sarah McCoy and all of her writing. We know you are going to too. You're going to want to connect with Sarah, and you can find her on her website at sarahmccoy.com. You can always also find her on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Pinterest. Thank you so much for joining us
Oh,
today.
this has been such a joy. I loved meeting you and your readers. Thank you so much. I'll come back anytime and chat with you.
We can't
Wonderful.
wait for you to come back. A pleasure meeting you. Just a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We could have talked to Sarah for like another 2 hours about all of the wonderful themes and emotions and messages within this book. And the one thing I wanted to expound on just a little is one of your questions that went with the quote in the book that I had actually made a note of. And Willie Mae said, quote, "If every woman grappled with the gnawing feeling that she could have been a better daughter, a better wife, a better mother, or just better." And Willie Mae thought, do we all grapple with this? I'm going to take it one step further. Not even women, but I believe men do too. I think we all at some point in our lives look back and say, could we have done something better or differently? How about you, Kristen?
Yeah, I have a friend who once said, you know, when you know more, you can do better. And I think the bottom line is we have to recognize that that struggle and those doubts, insecurities, concerns, that's a part of the human condition. So we got to accept it and we do better the next day, the next day, the next day. And in fact, the character that we're talking about decided today is the day that I'm going to try to be a better mother. Absolutely. What a hopeful message. But I think people need to also understand the message that that is a normal part of the human condition. And, you know, when a person says they have it all together and they don't have doubts and regrets and concerns about their past choices, then I think that's a person who probably is still working a lot of things out. How about you?
I think it's a healthy perspective too, because this is the journey through life, isn't it? That we are younger and we look back and we realize we've learned and we've grown and we've changed. And I think that is the healthy journey. And much to, I love what Sarah said about her characters, and she looks through these historic figures. She does not judge them. She said, I just want to explore and understand them. And I love that she said that because I feel that we should be doing more of that today, depending on people's different courses and their different choices and mistakes that people have made, sort of have a little more of a patient understanding and dive a little deeper. I just love that part of her book. The other thing that hit me was this super wealthy island with all the celebrities and the designer clothes and handbags. And at one point, Willie Mae's daughter Hilly arrives, who was a model in Manhattan, and she's suffering from very severe anorexia. And we've discussed this before on the podcast, but what a danger we enter in when we, as human beings, declare one thing beautiful and another thing not. And I feel that this is compounded upon us by societal standards, that our natural organic notion of beauty has been altered and polluted really a lot by society. Do you feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. I always think about this, and you and I have talked about this many times, where there's this idea of what's objectively beautiful versus subjectively beautiful. And I think with social media, it gets a little tricky now because what is subjectively beautiful can change in a few weeks, months, or even a year's time. But it speaks to very significant things like body image or what is a beautiful figure. That changes when we have social media driving some of that very quickly. I think this is where we get into a lot of difficulty with our teens who are impressionable, our young people, even preteens. And so this book did toy with some of those themes, and I thought that was really, really well done.
Mm-hmm. And I see a little bit of change in advertisements and magazines today where they're showing lots of people from different cultures, different nationalities, different shapes and sizes, and I find it very refreshing. But there's one thing I think of on occasion, but I'm also guilty of it. Okay, these high-heeled shoes, these designer shoes, they're 4, 5, 6 inches tall. We walk around with them, and I can't help, because I think too deeply on most things, that an anthropologist 100, 500, 1,000 years from now may look back and say, that is the most ridiculous thing that they are wearing. They can barely walk in those shoes, and yet this is our notion of beauty. Yeah. Almost as if we would look back 1,000 years ago to the first inhabitants of the earth and see what they may have considered prized or more worthy or beautiful to don themselves with. It can be almost comical.
It is. Well, I think fashion is, you know, particularly susceptible to these subjective notions of what is beautiful. And a lot of that is driven, of course, by money and capitalism and advertising and driving those dollars back to these corporate interests. So,
absolutely. Well, what's on your radar? What else? What's your takeaway? And what are you thinking about here?
Yeah. First of all, after this book, there's so much to think about. But I was really thinking about the impact of colonialism and looking at these existing cultures versus what was being impressed upon those cultures. You know, like in this book, we had a high tea being impressed upon an island where there was no real concept of, you know, time in the way that the British were looking at time. This is the time when we have high tea. So that's really kind of stayed with me since I've read this book, and I've been really thinking about that. How about you? What's on your radar?
I think that's very interesting because I've lived in a lot of different places, some very remote, all over the United States. And after I leave these places, people will say to me, oh, it must have been so horrible there. The people are so lazy. Does anyone do anything? And I right away thought, how very ignorant to just assume that someone in a different part of the country or the world, including a Caribbean island, as Sarah said, she's from Puerto Rico, how very ignorant of those of us who believe we are in a civilized major city to assume that people who don't live exactly like us are any less intelligent or intellectual or driven or possess deeper emotions. And that was my one life lesson from traveling all over, is never to undermine a different culture or begin to assume that you know more than them just because their lifestyle is somewhat different. And they did that with the colonization. They did that in even the United States with our indigenous Native Americans. We came in, we assumed them to be savages, and the British, that wasn't me, I'm Swedish, they came from Sweden, Germany, and tried to impose their own culture upon that people as if it was something better. And it wasn't.
Yeah.
No, well, that was a good point.
Absolutely. Again, this is a book that we could spend hours and hours discussing some of those themes, but look at how important it is to talk about them.
It sure is. That's what we love about this podcast. We talk a little bit about the plot, but a lot about the hot button topics and life-inspiring issues behind it. So we're going to close our podcast today with a shout out to you know who. You know his name by now. He's become a little mini celeb right here on the show. He's our sound engineer and also our producer, the Mr. Mark Carey. Mark, come on over here and say hello. We wouldn't be anywhere without him.
Hello. I hope you guys enjoyed the show and have a good one.
Thank you, Mark. And also, I have to tell everyone, do you like our theme song? It's our intro and exit song. Kristen and I think it's really cool, and we're super happy to say that song was actually written for us by a local Western New York band called Good Caleb, and we are super thankful to them because it really embodies who we are here today. A little suspenseful, a little intriguing. Super thankful to them. Stay on the radar with Kristen and I. Check out our webpage, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And if you want to read ahead, our spring lineup is fantastic. We're going to be interviewing Ellen Marie Wiseman and the Lost Girls of Willowbrook, Charmaine Wilkerson and Black Cake, Dolan Perkins Valdez, and Take My Hand.
Remember, listeners, one of the best ways to brave the storm is to dive down deep into life-changing fiction.
Thank you.